So good evening, everyone. I have a couple of announcements tonight. I wanted to first of all thank Susie, who is not in here right now, for covering for me last week. She stepped in at the last minute because I had to be out of town. So that's what I like about Kadampa. You know, someone's got your back, and you can't do it, and someone just steps up and does it. Next week, everybody, is Venerable Robina is going to be teaching. Steep's going to just sit in the back row and heckle her. So I think we'll have a big turnout. It's the first night she'll be teaching next week. And if she's teaching on emptiness, I think we'll have a lot of people show up. One other thing I wanted to talk about, I know some folks are doing all the readings and doing the completion cards in order to get the Discovering Buddhism certificate. Is there anyone here tonight who's doing that? Good, okay. Well, I wanted to just take a few minutes to talk about the 14th module. There are 13 teaching modules which we hold here at the center. But there is a 14th practice module that is not class-based. It is... What's going on over there? It's him. It's a practice module. Okay, I'll try to talk over him. If the practice module is pretty intense, it's talking over Robert Thurman. It's 100,000 Vajrasattva mantras, 100,000 prostrations to the 35 Buddhas, and a Nyingma retreat. But it is also required is what they call the 2-week Kopan style Lamrim course. There's a course that's offered every year in November, I think, at Kopan Monastery in Kathmandu. That is 2 weeks, and it's basic Lamrim. So I asked the question, we have this Light of the Path retreat coming up this summer. It's a 2-week retreat. And I wanted to know if that would qualify for this requirement. So we talked to Tom Trudy, who's the Director of Educational Services at FPMT, and he said, yes, it can count as a 2-week Kopan-style retreat. They're not quite the same, and that there are more formal meditation sessions in the Kopan course, but Light of the Path does have some, and in addition has Lama Chopa in the morning and protective prayers in the evening. So if you want to meet these requirements for the practice part of Discovering Buddhism, I would really strongly suggest you do the 2-week retreat in Black Mountain this summer, August 14th to 28th, in the comfort of your own state, and you save round trip ticket to Kathmandu. So think about it, and I encourage all of you to think about doing the retreat. You don't have to do 2 whole weeks. You can do a weekend, a week, 2 weeks, whatever works for you. It really is a remarkable experience. Yes.
Also, we'll talk a lot more about this practice module thing the last class of.
I just wanted to know if you were kind of in the middle of the modules, if you go to the retreat, if it would still count if you haven't finished everything.
I think so because I think it would work.
Oh, you mean if you skip DB to go to the retreat?
No, not skip DB. If you haven't completed all 13 modules.
Oh, you don't do them in order. That's okay.
Okay.
But we'll, and save some of your questions about that practice module. And, I think don't you still get a certificate for going through the classes? And then there's a different, Okay. No? But I think, I think there's something that they're trying to do now. Anyway, we'll talk about the practice module because it feels like climbing, Mount Everest. But there are some things that can be switched out for other things, and so we'll talk about it. Okay, so welcome. Anybody here new for the first time? That's good. It's really hard to start over every, like Groundhog Day, every Monday. Okay, so let's start with, we're going to actually start with the refuge prayer and four immeasurables. And remember, as you're doing this, that the purpose of any of these prayers is to make your mind and the prayer the same thing. It's not that we're asking for something outside of ourselves to occur. I mean, it would be nice, but we're also asking, you know, we're saying these things to try to change our mind. And so what page is that on again? 20? 34? Okay, thank you. And I need glasses. Okay, and we say, so we're going to say refuge. That's it. Yeah, let's just do refuge three times, and then we'll do the four immeasurables, which is somewhere. Okay. All right. Thank you. It's been a long day. All right. So let's do refuge. But this isn't the same page we do before. Not 34. 20. Oh, I'm on 24. No wonder. No wonder. It had refuge on 24, believe it or not. Okay. Thank you. Here we go. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for hatred and... Okay. So just take a minute to think about your reason for being here. We try to kind of raise our intention to the highest level we can imagine. And we're talking about emptiness, how things are dependent on causes and conditions. So the consciousness that you are experiencing, your keeper of the river right now, is based on previous moments of consciousness. So what we're trying to set our intention so that that river of consciousness can become the most incredible source for yourself, for everyone around you that is affected by you. Now the ripple effect is something can hardly grasp. So we're just focusing on what our potential is and how every little action of body, speech, and mind goes into making this next moment and the next moment and the next moment. So we generate that wish, the highest wish possible as we begin the class tonight, and then at the end we'll dedicate that merit. Then get into a comfortable meditative posture, because we've been talking about focus meditation, so we're going to spend a little bit more time today on focus meditation. So if you're in a chair, make sure your feet are flat on the floor. And remembering that you have a couple of goals in focus meditation. The first goal is to minimize the time that you've forgotten what you're supposed to do. And what you're supposed to be doing is counting your breath and just bringing your thoughts back, your mind back, over and over again to that. So you want to minimize the time that your mind strays from the count, right? Your power of memory will improve. This just takes practice. And it's hard sometimes on a Monday after work to do this, but you're welcome to come sit up here and face everybody. It kind of gives you a little extra boost to stay awake. So your first goal, again, is to make sure you're doing the count, minimize the time you've forgotten it. And your next goal, then, is to notice when your mind is about to wander away from watching the breath, before you actually wander away. If you can do that, that's huge, to notice, oh, there goes my mind. Let me try to gently bring it back. If you can see it, see your thoughts almost as waves rising up on an ocean, you'll be able to see when they subside, and there'll be a longer period between waves that you can rest in. So you immediately spot when your thoughts are rising up, and you kind of shine a light on it. You can label it. This is my mind wandering away, and try to bring it back to the breath. Okay, so we'll do this for about 8 to 10 minutes, and I'll let you know when time is up. And if you hear a noise or you need to get up, that's fine. That's fine. We can use all of it to help our minds stay focused. How'd that go? Good. Good for Monday. Any burning questions before we kind of, you know, now next week Rabina's coming, so a lot of the questions y'all just say, let's save for her. But anything that's come up from last week to this week that you want to make sure we cover tonight? Because we are going to do another meditation later on the four-point analysis, which I talked to Geshe a little bit about some of the questions and some of the things that came up last time. So I have a bit of that, but he just kept telling me, everybody has to do the four-point analysis. You have to, he goes, without that, no one's going to ever make any progress. And something he's reiterated, which I said before here too as well, when you're meditating on emptiness, we've been talking about the cup and the table and the this and the that, but it really should start with the emptiness of the self and meditating on that. And that's why we talked last week about first finding that self, which you then refute, right? So it's finding that sense of self, that false sense of self, which is the one that we're trying to analyze and see its falseness. The relative self, the conventional self, exists. It's not that you disappear. And actually in the videotape we'll watch later on, it's a section of one we're going to watch each week, because I love the way Robert Thurman teaches, and you can find it on YouTube later on your own as well. But he said something in one of his other ones, and I think it's in this one too, that kind of gets at what something you had talked about after we meditated last week, about you were looking at kind of this ego that you were trying to push to the side and then felt like this kind of like empty shell feeling. And I really, so I've been, was thinking about that question this week. Does that make sense to everybody? But I'm trying, he was meditating and trying to look at the I that we're refuting, that this kind of ego sense that he was trying to let go of, and he said then there was this kind of overwhelming sense of, well, then all that was left was like this empty shell. Did I get that right? More or less? Okay. So what Robert Thurman was saying, which I really, really liked his answer to that, was we are so used to identifying with what he's calling an absolute self, an absolute feeling of I, that when we start to meditate on it and unpack it, you know, dissolve that, it kind of takes with it for a while, for a second, that the relative I, because we're not used to doing that. And so when we start dismantling that solid sense of I, that absolute with a capital A, I, sometimes what happens is that feeling that he described, that like, well, then there, what is there? Because it takes with it for a moment in meditation that sense of a relative self, because we have them all mixed up together. The relative self exists. We were talking about the two truths, the conventional truth. You exist, you know, you're going to be paying your taxes pretty soon. If you don't, someone will find you. They'll find you. Even if you can't find you, they'll find you. And then you'll be paying more. So, you know, you exist on this conventional level. It's just this other way that we have of thinking of ourselves is what is empty. That's what's empty. So that was that answer, which we'll keep coming back to. And all of this whole topic, it's not something so easy just to say, okay, here, read this, and now you got it, let's meditate on it. It's this kind of constant circling around it. Oh, this really doesn't make sense. Oh, wait a minute, now it kind of does. And you were talking, Susan, about personality, and how does that fit into the emptiness of the self? Well, just remember that what we're talking about, that everything depends on causes and conditions, right? So then, does personality depend on causes and conditions? And then sometimes people would go back and say, yeah, but look at the difference. Even at birth, you can see almost personality differences between infants, I suppose, right? So, but then that's why Buddhists would talk about previous causes and conditions carrying over into a very young child that you would notice right away. But so if you just keep coming back to that, and even in our language, you know, we use the term, it depends, all the time, you know. Can you eat? Well, it depends, you know. I mean, we use that term all the time, and it means the exact same thing. Except now we have to apply it to everything. Everything depends. Everything depends on something else. And that's why it's not as solid as we sometimes think it is. So everything is relative. We talked last time about also, you know, we know some of these things, that the philosopher who talked about you can't find the middle point in the race. You know, the racer's trying to run to the finish line. Where's the middle? You can always divide. You can never find the absolute middle, because you can keep dividing that over and over and over again. So there's no absolute middle. That's the exact same thing we're talking about. There's no absolute self conventionally we can cut something in half, but there's no absolute. Okay, so any other questions that have been knocking around? That's pretty good. What'd you say? Depends, right? It does depend. Oh, and then I was thinking about your question about, and I actually asked Geshe-la about it. I think you said, you know, what about a young child, you know, pre-verbal, doesn't have a language thing, because we've been focusing so much on the base and the label. And so I asked Geshe-la if this was right, because I said, my answer would kind of be that even without a language, even with, you know, an animal and their language or an infant, you're still relating to things and pretty quickly labeling them in some way. So I remember my niece was teething and my sister had some homeopathic things she would rub on her gums, right? So my niece pretty quickly recognized when my sister was going for that bottle and she'd grin because she got a little buzz off of it or something, you know? And so, but she would see my sister going for that and she's all excited. So even if she didn't have a name for it and couldn't say any word, she already was relating to things as either positive, negative, or neutral. Right, so there's some way of labeling it. And Geshe-la was just saying too that, well, but everything, he said, don't worry too much about the language part, just know that everything that any being with consciousness is relating to is made up of parts and comes into being based on causes and conditions. And so in that way, they're having that same relationship with something regardless of the language. Okay. Trying to think if there was any other. Oh, and then you had a question about, see how good I remember all these questions that I can't answer. I go running to Geshe-la. And he said, oh, this is about space. You were asking about space because we had talked about space, outer space being permanent, you know. And so we would not refer to that as inherently existing. Inherently existing is different than always existing. And he said, even something that's permanent, like space or emptiness, even though it's not, there's not causes and conditions for space, there's parts. It can still be broken into parts, and that all depends. So on Earth, we can point to a part of our country and say that's north. That's not an absolute north, because you go to the moon, and you know, is that north? You know, so, but it's all relative. But there's still parts that we have labeled certain things, and we can point to the sky and this part of the sky and this zodiac and this, you know, this solar system in space. So I hope that helps. That it can still be broken into parts that we use to categorize, but it's different than this coming into being by causes and conditions, or our self being brought into existence based on those things. All right. So let's see. You can throw more out there. I'll get more answers for you. So I want to go over the four-point analysis and schedule and impress upon me how important that is. And we talked about it before, but I want to read it to you again, and we'll also do a little bit of a meditation on it before we watch the video. So I'm going to read two different things about it. Okay, the 4 points of the 4-point analysis with respect to a person are identifying the person as it is misconceived by ignorance, by our current state. So identifying the person or the way we perceive of self as it's misconceived. And that one is pretty much going to take up the entire time. I mean, once you identify that, though, the rest is really kind of all falls into place. He said, yeah, it's the main one of really identifying the self that is to be negated. Then the other part is deciding that if the self exists in the way that we think it is, then it must be findable either in relation to our mind-body complex or independently of our mind-body complex. Right? So it has to be found either within the aggregates of mind and body, or outside of them, if you're going to be able to find this thing we're calling self. So if that's the first thing, deciding if that's even true. And if you can think of a third way that the self could be found, then please let us know. But that second part is just you as an analyzer deciding that. Then the third one is then proving to yourself that such a person is not findable in relation to the mind-body complex. So proving that the self or the person is not findable in relation to, that's part of the meditative analysis that you would go through. You'd be looking for the self in relation to that. And then the fourth is proving that the person is not findable independently of the mind and body complex. All right, and so that's a really critical thing to know. Let me read another part of it. It's pretty much the same thing. The first point is to identify the object negated in the proof of emptiness. You know, we're identifying the self. We talked before about sticking a pin in your finger, or I was reading this other. It's just when the self really arises, it's something really strong. You know, sometimes when we're angry, somebody insults us. But I read another one, like if there was a near miss, somebody almost hit you in a car, that feeling of, you know, it's not just fear, but that feeling of what it was that almost got creamed by a car. You know, that sense. It's not that you shouldn't be have a reaction to that, but that sense of I rises up so strongly that it's easy to identify it and go, oh, that's the I that I think is the solid thing. The second is to be convinced that if a truly existent person was real, then it should be found in the body and mind or completely separate from the body and mind. And so then again, the third, you look for it in the body and mind, and the fourth, you look for it independently. And then that's when, if you find the emptiness of this truly existent person, that's when you focus on that emptiness, that feeling of like, okay, I can't find that truly existent person. I know the relative one exists, but I can't find that solid thing. And that's when you use that single-pointed placement, that meditation we were just practicing, of focus. That's when you put all of that ability right on that feeling. And then you try to let that, it's very hard to put into words, but you just kind of sit with that. Okay. Any questions about that? I think that's in some of the reading. Maybe not, but it's definitely in the Lam Rim. If you have Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand, it's definitely in there because it's a classic meditation. All right, so I'm going to walk you through. Yeah, sure, I'm sorry.
I was just wondering if I could ask if this would be correct when you're trying to look for that self, that false self, that feeling that you get when, you know, you're nervous in front of a crowd.
Mm-hmm.
Is that some that part of that what we're looking for?
Yes, absolutely. That
okay.
That's perfect. And then even asking yourself, who is this that's getting nervous? And again, on the relative level, we all know that feeling. It's not that we shouldn't have that feeling, but it's a chance to really explore what we think of as that solid sense of a person. Yeah. It's really hard to put language to all of these things. So I have in this book, a lot of you have How to Meditate. There's a meditation on emptiness that I'm going to read to you and walk us through it. And some of it's not, for me, when I was looking at it today, it's not like some kind of meditations that are visualizations where I'll lead and then let kind of you just kind of go on with this. It's a lot of words. So, but just notice your reaction as I read through it. Okay? Just notice where you go with it when I read through it. All right, so get back into a comfortable position. Let's see if I can find it. And put all of your, get into a good posture. Take a couple of cleansing deep breaths. Let all the fatigue and mundiness just go out from you. Just exhale all of that. Inhale some clean, clear energy. Remember, and knowing that we're going to now focus a little bit more on emptiness, but we're not throwing too much out. We're just looking at the emptiness of the false self. You definitely exist. But we're trying to distinguish between the valid I and the fabricated one. The relative I and the absolute I, and just starting to dissolve the long habituated beliefs in the solid absolute I. So now, with the alertness of a spy, slowly and carefully become aware of the sense of I. Who or what is thinking, feeling, and meditating? How does it seem to come into existence, this I? How does it appear to you? Is your I a creation of your mind? Or is it something existing concretely and independently in its own right? And if you think you can identify it, try to. Try to locate it. Now, where is your I? Is it in your head? Your eyes? Is it in your heart? Your hands? Your stomach? Obviously, we need these things, but is it in one of them in particular? Carefully consider each part of your body, your internal organs, blood vessels, nerves. Can you find your eye? It might be very small and subtle, so consider the cells in your body, the atoms, the parts of atoms. If some of these parts of your body didn't exist, would there still be an I? After considering your body, again ask yourself how your I manifests its apparent existence. Does it still appear to be vivid and concrete? Is your body the I or not? Perhaps you think your mind is the I. The mind is constantly changing stream of thoughts, feelings, experiences, coming and going in rapid alternation. Which of these is the I? Is it the loving thoughts? Angry thoughts? Happy feelings, depressed feelings, which one is the I? Is your I the meditating mind, the dreaming mind? Can you find the I in your mind? Is there any other place that you can look for the I? Could it exist somewhere else or in some other way? Examine every possibility that you can think of. Again, look at the way that your I actually appears and feels to you in different situations. Again, look at the way your eye actually feels and appears to you. After this search for it, do you notice any change? Do you still believe that it's as solid and real as you felt before? Does it appear to exist independently in and of itself? So next we're going to disintegrate some things just to see what it feels like. Just as a spy, as a scientist. So in your mind, mentally dissolve anything that you're sitting on. And now, and the building. All these things brought into being based on causes and conditions, they're mentally dissolved and you're sitting on the ground. Just imagine that. All of these impermanent things dissolving and you're sitting on the ground. And then imagine this planet that you're sitting on, also brought into existence based on causes and conditions, dissolves. It's impermanent. It won't last forever. And now you're sitting in space. And then you start to dissolve your body, brought into existence based on causes and conditions, impermanent, will not last. And it dissolves. And then you imagine you, your name, your history, your experiences, your thoughts, your feelings, your profession, your skills, your happiness, your unhappiness, all of this impermanent, brought into existence based on causes and conditions, dissolves. Let every thought, feeling, sensation, and perception float away and stay with this experience of space without being distracted as long as you can. When the feeling of an independent, inherent I recurs, analyze it again. Does it exist in the body? In the mind? How does it exist? Don't make the mistake of thinking, my body is not the I, and my mind is not the I, therefore I don't exist. You do exist, but not in the way you instinctively feel. That this is independent and inherent. Conventionally, yourself exists in dependence upon mind and body. And this combination is the basis to which our conceptual thoughts ascribe the name I, or Steve, or Richard, or Ashley. This is the you that is sitting and meditating and wondering, maybe I don't exist. Whatever exists is necessarily dependent upon causes and conditions or parts and names for its existence. This is how things exist conventionally, and understanding interdependence is the principal cause for understanding a thing's ultimate nature, its emptiness. The conventional nature of something is its dependence upon causes and conditions. Its ultimate nature is its emptiness of inherent independent existence. Think now about how your body exists conventionally, independence upon skin, blood, bones, arms, legs, organs, cells, and so on. in turn, each of these exists in dependence upon their own parts, cells, atoms, and subatomic particles. Think about your mind, how it exists in dependence upon thoughts, feelings, perceptions, sensations, and how in turn each of these exists in dependence upon previous conscious experiences that gave rise to them. Now go back to feeling of self, to the feeling of self or I. Think about how you exist conventionally, in dependence upon mind and body and name, the self's parts. When the body feels hungry or cold, for example, you think, I am hungry, I am cold. When the mind has an idea, you say, I think, I have an idea. When you feel love for someone, you say, I love you. When introducing yourself to someone, you say, I am so-and-so. Apart from this sense of I that depends upon the ever-flowing, ever-changing streams of body and mind, is there an I that is solid, unchanging, and independent? The mere absence of such an inherently existing I is the emptiness of the self. Okay, and then gradually open your eyes and come back. How did that go? Pretty good? Everybody's here? Yeah, here, here. Go ahead. You think you're here? I think you're here.
I had a sense of panic. I'm not in any of these spaces you're talking about. And then I thought of, well, what is... The teachings talk about true reality, and how does that connect with all of this?
Give me an example.
Well, I was panicked that I wasn't anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't seem to find it other than in my thought process and my synapses.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't touch it or feel it. It's just a conventional. But then I was thinking about emptiness, and the teachings they mention about true reality and understanding true reality, mm-hmm. or knowing true reality.
Mm-hmm.
And does that have to do with all the dependent arising,
mm-hmm.
and interdependence and emptiness?
Mm-hmm. So sometimes the ways that people use terms are kind of tricky, so that's why I want to make sure I understood. People sometimes interchange them, and but just like one of the things I was reading is that you can't find yourself in those things as an independent entity. All that you experience are dependent on all of those things, and so the true reality is the emptiness of the way. Man, let me even read that again. The very last sentence. I can find it. The mere absence of such an inherently existing I is the emptiness of the self. And I would say that that's what they would say are the true reality. And, you know, we kind of get it intellectually, but we're not getting it completely, because it would be like an atom bomb going off in our head, you know.
And I'm thinking that's maybe where my panic is.
Yeah. Well, see, that's a very good thing to identify. Where's that panicky thing? Because we can kind of like, yeah, I get it. We're not independent. We're dependent on causes and conditions. But it's good to get to that point because that's separating then that it's like what we were talking about before when we kind of start unpacking this absolute I. It for a moment takes with it that relative I and we get scared like, where am I? And that, you know, we're, it's so hard to put into words, but so it's that relative self that exists. It just doesn't exist in the way we think it does as this absolute self. And we get, you know, all of us think of it that way, but it's just such a habit. And it also brings us some comfort. And so when we think that it doesn't exist that way, then how in the world do I exist? And it's looking at, and were you here when we talked about the river? And so you can't put your foot in the river, the same river twice. So, you know, if that was a conscious thing, that river would kind of freak out. Like, oh my God, you can't? You can't put your, I'm not the same thing you can put your foot into twice? You know, if we personified that river. You just did that. You did exactly that. You know, so you're recognizing, you're the river right now. And you just recognize, oh my God, I'm not the same person that I just started, you know, with. And so, you know, it ties into this whole process of liberating ourselves, because without that real understanding of how we exist, then we're just in the dark. You know, we're doing things in the dark over and over and over again. We might have a little more light here and there, but it's not the whole picture. So, yeah. And then, wait, you had your hand up first.
No, I'm just holding.
Oh, you're just holding the mic. Okay.
Two things. One, all through my life, when I look in the mirror, every so often, if I'm really just looking at myself, I don't know what I'm looking at.
Yeah.
And so over the years, it's the same problem over and over again.
Uh-huh.
And I was thinking here, let's say just again, personality. Mm-hmm. Would I recognize myself in another life? Would I ever I get nervous about, or nervous is the wrong word. I have a concern that, all right, I like this life. I want to stay like this. But after I die, that's gone. So what if in the next life it's not as good as this? Will I know that, or does it matter? And it comes down to this little nub of,
Well,
you don't know what you are.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it comes down to. Me. Like at night, if it's dark, but light enough to see a little, and I walk, let's say I'm going to the bathroom and I walk past a mirror,
mm-hmm.
and I see a Hulk,
mm-hmm.
not me, just mm-hmm. a shadow going by. Sometimes it scares me,
because
mm-hmm. I forget that I'm...
That you're not the Hulk?
Well, that I don't know what I look like then.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how to put it. I can't. I want to remember myself,
right.
And I think that's what catches me.
That's a good thing to know. That's a really good thing to know. That point of like, you know, we're attached to ourselves.
Yes.
You know, and it's like, oh, another life I would have a completely different personality, and wouldn't even be recognizable to me. Okay. So that's that sense of me, and you know this. That's the difference between the way that some people look at soul as this constant thing versus consciousness, which is this constantly moving and shifting thing. But I would say to the fear that it arises, you might want to try this antidote to that fear, is that instead of identifying with the you in this life or the you in another life, the potential that you have.
Okay.
To identify the incredible potential that we all carry.
Look ahead.
Yeah. And not just even ahead, as a river, okay, as the consciousness of Susan, that you're the keeper of, Susan's right here in this bend in the river, the incredible potential this river has. And so instead of, I mean, I'm not trying to diminish your feeling, but just trying to give you an antidote to the fear of like, you have so much opportunity in this bend in the river to create the next part of the river, right? And so you might not be recognizable to yourself, certainly when you're enlightened, you'd be able to recognize all those lifetimes, how one led to another. And just, and the fear of losing who you love now, I would try playing around with this idea, though, of meditating on the incredible potential, the Buddha nature that we all have inside of us, and that you're moving towards opening that flower.
That helps. I think the reason I brought in the looking in the mirror is I look in the mirror and I think, what are you? And then when I'm meditating, I'm thinking, you don't want to lose yourself, but
right.
What are you?
Okay.
So this...
Yeah. What you are in that kind of a thing, I was just, for me personally, I would meditate on is I am this incredible potential.
Thank you.
You know, and, you know, you don't, yeah, it's this, it, but you know, it's this feeling of like I lose this life, you know, this form, these set of experiences will be over and done with, you know, but nothing's completely over and done with because it creates the next and the next and the next. So, there's something I was going to say about all that. But I mean, I think that's the thing we're trying to identify. And then you're all doing a great job of touching on those things. Because we're so busy, we don't really, that feeling doesn't get called up very often until it's kind of too late. Yeah.
So then, is the potential just that element of potential that experience of pure potential?
Uh-huh. Is that what?
That's not emptiness.
Because so that's, I'm talking about like the seed that we're all carrying, right? It's not an inherently existing seed. It's just like any seed. If I picked up an acorn, you would not be able to tell me where that acorn started. Because it came from a tree, that came from another acorn, and, you know, we just could go on forever.
Yes.
You're carrying that seed through to enlightenment, is what I'm telling Susan. And so that seed is the seed of enlightenment. You know, when we realize emptiness, you know, we're right there. Then we're going to be enlightened. Okay? So, is the seed emptiness? It's certainly part of the puzzle. It's certainly part of the puzzle. It's not emptiness with a big E is way bigger than just that seed. You know? That's maybe a better way of saying it. So, I suggest we watch this 10-minute clip because he'll probably answer all these questions a lot better. So this is Robert Thurman, who is a professor at Columbia, also Uma Thurman's father. And he is, I think, I don't know if he's head of Buddhist studies or comparative religious studies or something like that. But he's come to Raleigh a couple of times. He knows Geshe-la now. And he's just a wonderful teacher. So what I'd like to do is show you this, and we're going to stop it like 10 minutes and 23 seconds. Okay, and then we will watch the next part of it on the class after Rabina. Probably that's it. And can people at home hear this? Chris? Okay, all right. It depends? Okay.
True nature of reality is bliss. It's near insist on being unenlightened, then you will come. Dhammacitta's so epic. You know, the only reason he did that, as Dalai Lama says, if he hadn't discovered bliss being the option that you have by choosing a different understanding, then and dispelling the illusory understanding that we are conditioned to by cultures, which mostly want us to suffer. You know, the elites of the different cultures, the high priests, the rulers, they want us to work. They don't want us to feel too good, because then we might not want to work all the time for them. So that's why in most societies in world history, bliss is illegal. In our country too, very much so. So anyway, we have the world totally upside down. We think that relative reality is absolute. We think we are absolute, each person about their own ego, about their own self. They think there is something in there that's the real thing. As my old uncle Andrew used to say, everyone is correct that they're real. Everyone is real. But the problem is everyone thinks they're really real. And they're their way off base. Actually, they're only unreally real. But that's still real enough to worry about, of course. Deal with it. But it's not that exaggerated level of being the absolute reality, yourself, the center of the universe, etc., and therefore others as sort of subsidiary to you, or possibly simply a matrix illusion, and you're the one. You know? And he used to say that too, like decades before the Matrix. He used to say, everybody goes around secretly thinking, I'm the one. And that's a problem. But Buddhism doesn't solve that problem just to dispel that illusion by everybody discovering that they don't exist. That would be also idiotic. If Buddha was going to say, oh, my discovery is that we all don't exist, so we're cool. like modern materialist scientists do. They go around claiming that they've discovered that there's no soul and therefore no future life, and therefore everybody's automatically cool. All you have to do is die. And then you'll return to your basically non-existent state, and they'll take your body and put it in a heavenly rest, a permanent sleep cemetery, and then you won't have any further problems. But that's what I would not agree with. That's not correct. The whole correction of enlightenment is to stop being the one, yourself. Realize you're not the one. You're one of the ones. You and other people are. Also, everybody else is the one too. And once you know that, and there's so many more of them, you automatically become an altruist. You become a bodhisattva, and you want to help them. And then you become happy rather than miserable. Anyway, we think our original self-identity is really us, and it opposes a world absolutely other, and that situation produces suffering. Right? That's really simple. It's not rocket science. It doesn't require major enlightenment, just a little bit of human enlightenment for us to deal with that idea, those ideas. Okay? Then, he looks for that self, that absolute self. It doesn't help to just say, oh yeah, I'm selfless. That won't help, because at the gut level, you still think you're absolute, and if you're unenlightened, I mean, you may all be enlightened by now, you've never been in the conversation. So, that's never mind if I'm shortchanging you. If you're enlightened, you don't mind. If you're unenlightened, you're offended if I assume that you're unenlightened. So, since I'm unenlightened, I'll assume that we all are. So, but Buddha realized his freedom from that separate selfhood, that absolute separateness from everything else, enjoyed the release of self, and thereby realize infinite interconnection with all life. And this is a central thing in my talk this morning, that the key about non-duality is that this right here now is non-duality. Non-duality doesn't mean that we're going to disappear into some vast state and all have an experience of like it's all one, but nobody's there. It's all, there's no problems because nobody's in the one. Because all the separate people are just an illusion, and we're an illusion, but we enjoy being just one with everything with nobody home. That's wrong. That is a mistake, but it is a mistake that many mystics make, actually, according to Buddhist tradition. That's the main thrust of what I'm going to talk about. So he discovered the release of the relative self, that is, he couldn't find it. But then he didn't make this mistake of thinking that he had found nothing, because he wasn't insane, like scientific materialists are. They think they found nothing after people die. They go to the corpse, and they put some electrodes on the corpse, and they say, oh, something's happening to the brain, so they don't exist anymore. We found them not being there. That's insane. You realize that that's insane. If you think you find nothing, that you're cuckoo. You know? And then would you expect a prize or an award or grant money for finding nothing? Finding nothing is a mistake. You just didn't find what you were looking for. It doesn't mean it isn't something isn't somewhere else. That there is no nothing. But you can't find it. That's very important. Remember that. If you die expecting to become nothing, you're going to be in for a problem, as Pascal understood. But in case you're correct, you won't have to worry. You'll just be nothing. And you won't be upset if you tried to learn to meditate and became mindful and tried to deal with yourself, your life, and acted as if everything in your life had a consequence, even for yourself in the future. If in case it does, then you'll be happy you worked on that. In case it doesn't, you're not going to mind. You know, you're going to join Carl Sagan saying, isn't it great, I'm nothing. Okay, so you see, therefore, it's the realization of...
Okay, so, yeah, you've never heard him before. He's a treat.
And we will, you know, this is a 40-minute clip, so we'll watch the rest of it in 10-minute increments for the rest of the time. But I really love the way he teaches, and he's funny, and he makes sense. He's talking about all the stuff that we're talking about. You know, any thoughts or questions from any of this?
You know, I wanted to share something.
Yeah, you could flip the light. Is it on?
When we did that meditation before this, and you kind of touched on it,
yeah.
You know, when you said imagine yourself sitting on the ground,
yeah,
and then you said it vanished,
yeah.
You know, I kind of got uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know, I was falling,
mm-hmm.
And I noticed that such an instinct it was to grab onto something that I thought was real to feel better.
Mm-hmm.
But then it was like. And don't think I'm weird. I'm a cartoon man. So
mm-hmm.
I was thinking how much easier it would be if I would just, you know, kind of let it go
mm-hmm.
and not get that fear. And I think of that Bugs Bunny cartoon
mm-hmm.
when he's up on a construction site and being chased. And he gets to the end of the metal pillar. It's an active construction site. And there's a crane there that has a plank ready to meet him. And
mm-hmm.
he wasn't even concerned about falling.
Right.
And that to me is... You know, not, you know, that I kind of connected that,
mm-hmm.
that I'm inherently, that I can't handle, I'm so inherently to grasp something.
Right.
That, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
To attach it to something. And I'm kind of, I know, maybe I'm sounding weird, but.
No, I mean, we live in that kind of, this is, I mean, we live in a conventional world and we don't look at this other part very often, you know, so we're not really exploring it very much. It's going to bring up all kinds of things. Yeah.
As he was talking, it made me think of a prior class that Don gave. We did a death meditation
mm-hmm.
and went down through the stages and trying to find this or negate the self when you start stripping away and
mm-hmm.
you lose, you know, different functions, bodily functions, and you get down to, it's like that last part before you go and move on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's kind of, as we were doing that meditation, I got that uneasy feeling like, oh, that's it. And then
mm-hmm.
you get this little glimpse of it, but you want to just stay there a little
mm-hmm.
bit, but you're automatically
mm-hmm.
move on. Now, is that kind of that subtle level of consciousness, or is that... Well, there is no self. Is that self? Is that what we're looking for?
We're looking for that sense of self. What we're really looking for is that sense of self that arises that is not real. So it's that panicky. If you're feeling that panicky thing, that sense of self that's being taken away when we're dissolving that absolute self. We're doing this analysis to see where is that self that we feel is so solid. And so this panicky feeling is because we're pulling the rug out from under ourselves in this meditation. It's not that we don't exist, but it's just like what we were saying in the beginning. In the beginning, you'll feel that very disorienting state because we're dissolving that sense of absolute self. But it's kind of like I said before, like surfing on an ocean or that whole river. To me, that's the best analogy. You're trying to see that you are that whole river. Of thought and your body, your mind. It doesn't mean that the river doesn't exist if you can't grab it. It absolutely exists. You can use it to incredible purposes. You know, look at what we do with rivers. But you can't. It's not existing in the solid way that we think it is. So that's the main point of that meditation, and it can have positive effects too. So usually, the first time I did that meditation, I just got so blissed out. I mean, I was like, wow, that's amazing. I don't know why, but I don't know. It just kind of freed me up. It was kind of a fun feeling. So it can have that too. You felt that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it can feel both. And so, but the good thing is when it feels panicky, that you're, because you're trying to identify that sense of self that is that solid thing. And then when you've found it, you have more of a chance of applying the antidotes and negating it. And, you know, it's like when, I love when he talks about, when he was here in Raleigh, he talked the same thing about, if you think you're going to get out of this, he goes, yeah, people think, oh, I'm going to get out of this. You're not going to get out of this dead. And it's not going to happen that you die and then, okay, I'm done with that, you know. it's not happening like that. And so he goes, next lifetime, you'll be up there on the stage giving a lecture. He said, it's just, but yeah, it might not be the same kind of self, you know. Somebody else had it. Yeah.
So when we're in this situation where we've let go of that panic and we've got this sense of what emptiness really is, or there's the, not the conventional self, but this potential
mm-hmm.
for the power in the river, as
mm-hmm.
it were,
mm-hmm.
what do we do with it?
Well, sometimes it almost arises almost like a body feeling. So they're just saying, stay with that, to try to put all of your awareness on that moment. If you're getting this little glimpse of like, oh, I can't actually find that independent I, then just and try to use all your focus meditation on that. So, and then tell us your experiences. Because it's hard to describe, but then that's what you're then trying to put all of your concentration on. That moment, because it's pretty soon, like as I was reading, when the inherent self, that self arises again, which it will, then do the same kind of analysis. It's almost the same as when we're trying to keep our mind on the count and it wanders off. So you'll see this moment of like, oh, and then it goes back to this, you know, but you're trying to expand that sense of like, oh, this more, this other experience of the eye.
How do we know we haven't reached our potential? This is as good as it gets.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think so?
I don't know.
Yeah. So that's a good question to ask yourself. I mean, even on a conventional level for me, I can look at people who are much better off. People who really inspire me, and I'm not at that state of consciousness yet, right? So if I say I see... Mother Teresa type or other people who really inspire me, then I know this is not as good as it gets. I can guarantee you this is not as good as it gets. So I don't have that worry. And then but that's some of why we study, that's actually, you know, a really good question. That's why we study different people's autobiographies, you know, and different saints, bodhisattvas' life stories. And in a traditional retreat, when you're sitting there doing all these mantras and meditations, what they suggest to do in between those sessions is to read those autobiographies so that you do become more convinced that there's more than just this. I have not reached my full potential. Now, if we're just talking about this lifetime, are we talking about the whole river? So that's the difference. If we believe that consciousness continues, then we get a little tripped up because we can't see all those other things. I used to tell Geshe-la it would be so much easier if we could see some of these enlightened states so that we could go, okay, I want to get there. Just like a movie. Why don't we have more movies about, you know, people reaching enlightenment? My goodness, we have the total opposite. What'd you say?
But if we haven't reached enlightenment, we haven't reached our full potential.
Yeah. And but so it's what I think is so hard is that we're not seeing all of that. We don't get to see those things, you know? We don't get to, like, sit down with Shakyamuni and have a chat, you know? I mean,
you can look back at, I mean, I've been doing this, I don't know, coming up on a year in April, and I can see definite for inside me improvements.
Right.
So, and if this continues, that's my motivation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I see. I mean, it's like tangible evidence of yourself changing.
Right.
You
know. It's a good point. It's a good point because we are changeable. We are flexible. And so sometimes it's even like, I found it helpful just to even take notes on the things that I have made progress with so that I can encourage myself because you hit brick walls. And then if I can't see it in me, I can certainly see it in other people and know that there are things that I definitely want to change. So I don't know if this is getting to your question. Is it?
Yeah.
And certainly then if we're looking at that next bend in the river, I know it can be better. And so I believe in evolution. You know, I believe that we evolve and we can change. And the point is for me to really focus on how do I want it? What are the things that I want to change? You know, what can I do right now to just keep propelling that, you know? I think I've given this example before. I wanted to bring it as a slide today, but you know, if you've ever been in New York City, you can look down a street and there's just buildings and then you can look down and see the river, right? And if you haven't been in New York, just imagine some city that you can't see very much this way, but you look straight down and there's one block of a river. And if you didn't know better, you might think, oh, there's a lake there. It's just one block of water. That's all there is. But if you sat there for a while and you used your analysis and you saw some boats moving through, you'd say, oh, wait a minute. It's coming from somewhere and it's going somewhere. You know, it's not just a square of water. And yeah, it seems to always be going that way. And then if you got up into one of those buildings and you looked down on it, you'd be able to see a lot more of the river. You wouldn't be able to see the source or where it's going necessarily, but you could see a lot more of that river. And so like that, you can start to convince yourself using analysis about your consciousness and what has brought certain things into this part that you're looking at and what you could put in there to continue it. You know, and so looking at impermanence and studying emptiness, we're gathering the tools necessary for ourselves to become Buddhists. I mean, that's what we're doing. And that's, you know, a lot of times you'll read in the text how amazing it, even if we can't see actual Buddhas, we have the ability to be able to see tankas and to read texts and to listen to people that others aren't able to. And that's not based on nothing. As Thurman says, you can't find nothing. So that comes from some cause or condition that we have put into our river that allows us to be even thinking about this topic. You know, for some people they wouldn't even be able to get their head even this far into it. So, you know, we've done that and we're continuing to do that work, and one day it'll ripen into our ability to see emptiness, and emptiness conjoined with bodhicitta is like boom. So we just keep working on them step by step and it will lead us somewhere. Any other thoughts or questions before we wrap this up? Oh, so next week when Venerable Rubina comes, there'll probably be a lot more people here. It'll be her very first day arriving in Raleigh. She's coming right from the airport, I think. Or maybe not right from the airport, but she's arriving that day. So it's hard to say. There might not be a whole lot more people. But when she comes, I should be here. But if not, you know, Joanna will be here and we'll just stand up when she comes in the room out of respect, and then she'll prostrate and sit down and we'll start with some prayers and then off we go. Yeah. Okay? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And she's been here many times. Yeah. Even when we weren't in this building. When we were in the little basement. So, yeah. All right, so let's take a minute to, just like we set our intention in the beginning, we're now going to dedicate the merit that each of us individually and together created by thinking about this topic. As I've said before, Geshe says many times, just thinking about emptiness for a few seconds purifies incredible amounts of garbage in our river. and plants a lot of seeds. So you have the opportunity now to think about how you would want these seeds to ripen. Think about how this merit can join with other merit to eliminate any obstacles in our mind streams to understanding this topic thoroughly and completely and achieving enlightenment, realizing emptiness, being able to see the true nature of how things exist, the true reality of things being interdependent, absent of inherent existing conventionally and ultimately, so we can achieve bliss for ourselves and others. Thank you all very much. Okay.